Welcome to Bookish. I am Kofi Adisa, and I'm with Sylvia Lee and Laura Yu. And this is our, I guess, our end of the semester Bookish. I just thought of that. We won't hear from each other for another month or so. Right. So welcome and farewell.
You're doing okay, Kofi?
Well, I was kind of thinking, like, do I say, you know, whatever. Anyway, how are you ladies?
We're good.
Well, it is the end of the semester, so if we're not entirely coherent, that's probably why.
Yeah, a lot of grading.
A lot of, yes, we're in the thick of it. This is our busy, one of our busiest times.
Yeah, and today we're going to be talking about the novel by Tope Folarin, A Particular Kind of Black Man. Tope Folarin is a Nigerian-American. He's an executive director of policy studies. He's originally from Utah. He lived in Perry, Texas. And in 2013, his story, Miracle, won the Kane Prize for African writing. And his was the first one outside of the continent to actually win. And I took some time to read the story, Miracle, and I found it, a lot of the same themes are in A Particular Kind of Black Man. There's this father with two boys, there's this missing mother, and there's this sort of religious or supposed religious experience that they're going through in the story Miracle. So I guess I want to start with, what did you ladies take away from the book other than some of the religiosity that I just mentioned?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Miracle. I want to start like there, even though that's not the book we're talking about. I've been assigning it for a while in one of my classes, and I find that's a story that I think surprises students. I hear a lot of students tell me, and this is for our listeners just to get a sense of like style and like writing voice, but I hear a lot of students tell me that it's not the usual type of story that they would gravitate towards. They tell me that the pacing is a bit slower. There's a lot of things that happen, but there's not a lot of things that like, it all happens in one place, essentially in one moment. And there's a lot of, you know, description. There's a lot of what you call interiority, Kofi. And a lot of students seem surprised that it is engaging them. But I think that is very much, you do a very deep dive in, which is why I found Folarin's like writing style to be so accessible, but also like relatable in a weird way. Like there's a lot that I see in the experiences that he writes about, both in that short story, but also in the novel we're talking about, that resonates so much with me, even though we have such different lives, you know? So that was one thing that I wanted to talk about. But I'm like really excited for this talk because I feel like there's so much to talk about. And I actually want to hear from Laura too, because she's read this book three times like in the past 2 months. So, and I read it twice. I read it again for this, but I read it once before, like a while ago. And even in my second reading, there's so much more that I was picking up on, just in terms of the idea of like fragments of identity, like how your identity can be fragmented and disjointed based off of, you know, experience and not just the main characters. And I found it really hard in this novel to separate Folarin from the character, although from Tunde, who is the main character, especially since like there's so many parallels in their lives. But I really felt the idea, I really saw the idea of like this idea of fragments and broken like selfhood and trying to figure that part out really come through in the second read. But yeah, I want to hear what Laura thinks after reading it three times.
Well, and I read it that many times only because I keep recommending it to people. And I, you know, read it first time by myself. And, you know, I didn't know about Folarin until I heard him interview when he was talking with the author of Friday Black. And now his name is escaping me, but then I read the book and then my book club was reading it. So I think I'm glad, Kofi, you mentioned the Kane Prize. One of the things that I learned when I was, you know, looking him up a little bit, I found it so fascinating that he actually was like shortlisted. Like he won in 2013, the Kane Prize, and then he was shortlisted again in 2016. And as you said, it was the first time that someone outside had won from the diaspora,
Africa,
I guess.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Outside Africa.
So apparently, in just a couple of articles that I read, that each time that there were critics or other artists who were questioning his Africanness as and his eligibility to be considered and even win this award, right, or this prize. And I found it so ironic. I don't know if ironic is the right word, because of course in this novel, and is he's trying to figure out the Americanness, right? Or ness of anything really in terms of identity, Africanness in America, but also Americanness, and what does it mean to be American as part of that identity question. So it points to something that I think people who sort of straddle two spheres of cultures, languages, histories, even for people who are born in America, when their heritage is from somewhere else, those two cultures, and it's always this constant back and forth between figuring out, you know, how Korean am I, how American am I, and how do I even measure that? And I feel like I was really drawn to that big question throughout this novel about Americanness and how we define that and what that means. Yeah, that really strikes me, the novel.
Yeah, one of the things that struck me was the emotion that was there, but also some of the sort of critiques that one would have when you're trying to figure out your identity. And especially, and I like the way you put that, Laura, when it's somewhere from somewhere else. And I think for Tunde, somewhere else is in the voice of the grandmother, because it's on a receiver, it's not really physically there. And so it's kind of like a metaphor for what's the past. You know, your grandmother is representative of that past. And his only connection to her, at least for the first third or so, are through either phone calls or letters that she sends him or something like that. And then when he goes to visit, you're sort of wondering, is this really happening, or is this what he imagines would it would be like, you know? But there's this one part on page 44 where I kind of felt like this was something I would see in Baldwin in some of his essays, when he's talking about, you know, older generations. And at the bottom, he's saying, much later, I would come to understand that the only way my father had survived in the United States in Utah was by doing exactly this, staring ahead always, kicking the pain and heartache away. This was how he was able to survive the torment of living in a place that never fully comprehended his presence, that sometimes treated him as if he were someone who would never really matter. This is how he survived the loss of his wife to a disease that prevented her from remembering him, and his love for her for more than a moment at a time. My father bore his burdens well. He was a walking, talking smile. And it's sort of this idea that his father, who has the heritage, you know, because he immigrated here, is not even treated in a way that it's respected, that it matters. And so he's seeing this Tunde as a young boy, and is coming to grips with what this means for him early on. And I kind of felt like this was something that I've seen in Baldwin, either some of his essays or like Notes from a Native Son, or even to some degree, Sonny's Blues, where he's capturing that moment when he's looking out at Harlem and seeing its decay at the same time, seeing the beauty of those people. Because I think there is a deeper emotion between the father and son, and that I think is explored here very well.
Yeah, that passage, I remember I bookmarked that passage and I wrote, this is such a, even though it's a specific story, it's such a quintessential like immigrant experience too, like the idea that, and I think that's why I find him just as a writer so like accessible to me, because I feel like that passage, you're right, it could come out of Baldwin, it could come out of a Robert Hayden poem, you know, like I'm thinking Those Winter Sundays, right? Like,
sure. You know,
the idea of like having to just not just survive, but like survive in a specific kind of way, I guess. And then that, you know, that passage also made me think of my dad too, and the idea of like how you bear it, you know, and how you, that idea of staring straight ahead and doing that. So I had a feeling, Kofi, before you came in, I was telling Laura, I had a feeling that we would be having very similar or like overlapping things that we're talking about. And for our listeners out there, this is a unique episode in that we decided there was a lot to talk about for this novel. And usually we prepare ahead of time, but this time we said, you know what? We're going to come right in here and we're just going to like, you know, see what happens. And that's why I'm really excited for this conversation, because I think the threads you're picking up on, Kofi, and kind of align so well with what Laura's saying and also what I experienced in reading the book. And for our listeners, just to give you a brief synopsis of the novel, A Particular Kind of Black Man, it's a novel that follows the story of Tunde, and who's the main character, and his family, his parents who come from Africa, from Nigeria, over, and they settle in Utah, where his father has originally received a scholarship to come and study mechanical engineering, which is a, you know, very a prestigious field, but, you know, owing to racism and other, you know, and limited opportunities due to that, he is never really able to really fully realize his potential. Well, at the same time, so Tunde and his brother, Tayo, are born here in the States in the 80s. And at the same time as they are growing up, their mother begins to decline in mental health. And ultimately, she's no longer able to care for the children and leaves the family. The family's broken up in that way, and the mother returns to Nigeria. And Tunde has to contend with figuring out who he is throughout the novel, and at the same time, like trying to, so the idea of like trying to understand through who he is through almost like a cracked mirror, where he can't really see himself very clearly. And much of that stems from this traumatic experience of losing his mother, even though she, you know, isn't dead, but like, you know, he loses her in many different ways. So whereas you saw the relationship with the father, I actually thought the relationship with the mother was so jarring to me. It was like really shaking. Like it kind of like, it stood out to me because in the mother, I saw Tunde's experience like first played out, you know, this idea of this fragment identity of people who live in the hyphen, right? Like African hyphen American, Korean hyphen American, you know, like the people who live and straddle both cultures and aren't fully accepted in either culture. But I saw in his mother, when she came over, what happens when you really can't reconcile those identities. And so when she comes to America, I saw her mental health issues and her decline really kind of a result of the trauma of trying to like find a place here, but not really having that place here, among other things. And then you see Tunde return to Nigeria to figure out who he really is. And one thing that really struck me in that was how he needed to return in order to see himself more clearly. And he describes this moment where he meets his extended relatives for the first time. And, you know, like you were saying, Kofi, he talks with his grandmother, and his grandmother's voice is the voice that's kind of like calling him home, or like a type of home to him. And I thought it was so interesting that when he meets them, his whole extended family, he begins to realize who he is and see himself as though he's looking at himself in a mirror for the first time. And he explains how the idea of like, so he used to only look at him as being a reflection of his mother and father, but when he sees his uncles and his aunts and he sees how he resembles them as well, he looks in the mirror and he begins to see all these different pieces making up his own reflection. And I thought that was so powerful in terms of recovering a sense of wholeness for yourself, and the idea that maybe that's only possible when you really have a understanding of not just your immediate family, but the idea of like genealogy too, and what that plays into it. And for so many people, that's gone, that's taken from them, or they just don't have access to that. And so like, what does that do to a person's understanding of themselves and also recollection of who they are, if that's what makes up a person's identity, right? So, and I think Tope Fallaron talks a little bit about, I was listening to this interview he did with NPR, where he talks about how in the novel, he wanted to focus on this idea of infected memories. Like what happens when, like, you know, you have these memories that are infected with the pain and the trauma of the past. And I thought that was so interesting, because then your memory is skewed or it's unreliable, and you're trying to use these things to understand who you are, and you can't reliably use them anymore. So where do you go from there? So anyways, yeah, those are some of the things that kind of struck me about this idea of like wholeness and like seeing yourself truly for who you are, and how difficult that is when you're contending with so much going on. Sorry, that was really long.
No. I thought that was well said. Laura, you look pensive. So I'm...
No, actually, I'm glad. I was hoping somebody would bring it up, that Sylvia said about, you know, about memory and the sometimes unreliability of memory, and takes us back to our last episode when we talked about unreliable narrators or things that are left ambiguous. And, you know, reading and reviewing the novel again, I think I just keep thinking, whoa, was the grandma real? Like, did those phone conversations happen? And so there is a particular kind of ambiguity that is meant to be there and part of the building of the character, right? We're supposed to, you know, and the ultimately, does it matter? Does it matter that that was a real conversation or not? I think what matters maybe is what it did for him while he was experiencing those phone calls. And at the end, asking us the question that is to, you know, maybe to focus on the effect of those phone calls rather than, you know, were they real or not. And it's so funny how often now, for me, the yellow wallpaper keeps coming up, because even in the structure of this novel, we see the falling apartness of his mind, or where he starts to fear that he got, he says something like, maybe my mother passed down whatever was wrong with her to me. And I think it's like maybe halfway through the novel, you start to see the structure of the novel kind of take different shapes. And that's so interesting to me, where he's experimenting with the way, the form of the novel, basically, too. So with things like hallucinations and depression. And so it's also exploring, on top of immigration, on top of these family saga, it's exploring mental illness and the legacy of mental illness, I guess, on the family. And then, like, even the notion of the blended family with when the stepmother comes and there are other children. And I think, you know, somebody had observed, that person felt that there was too much going on in the novel, that, you know, there were too many different elements to contend with or struggle with or work through. And I could see that for some readers, that being the case. But I guess for me, it sort of made it kind of just a compacted version of, you know, in 200 some pages, like a version of real life where we don't get to just only deal with immigration today and let me tomorrow deal with mental illness or whatever, but they all come as a package. And I think that's what's so engaging. At every turn of the page, like, there's something going on in not just action, but things to think about. And I'll just end with this one, because this is my favorite part of the story, the ice cream truck. So when Tunde's father buys a truck and, like, retrofits it to make it into an ice cream truck, and there is this, like, such almost naive and sweet and optimistic and ambitious drive in that action, and how much he believes in this, and the whole family, like, working on this ice cream truck, and the kids just trying to get some ice cream and by driving around town with dad. And that section, I cried and laughed so much. It was just so moving for me, the optimism, but also the desperation, right? Like, they needed this to work, right? And, you know, I don't know, that to me, the picture of the ice cream truck, like, I feel like that's a very American thing, the ice cream truck. So it really sticks with me as, like, an imagery of, like, this Americanness that he's exploring in the novel. But how the family sort of jumps into this ice cream truck business and what it comes to mean for them and all the emotions that ride on this ice cream truck. It was a really powerful imagery, and it's not even sad, but I think it's the sweetness of it that made me, like, just so emotional. It was like ugly crying and then laughing because it's so cute and funny, and then crying.
You know, one of the things about that scene, having not grown up as an immigrant or a family whose family immigrated to the United States, I was very much good friends with people who you could classify as that. And my buddy's father and mother opened up a restaurant. It wasn't really a restaurant, it was more like a carryout, but everybody was all in. And it was just it was like a community thing. And so I would, like, grate, they were from the Caribbean. And I would grate the ginger, I would, like, you know, shave the cassava, I would do all these things. I'm learning all this culture kind of because I'm friends with somebody. But it was the first time that I saw the sort of stereotype about, you know, the Horatio Alger, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Mm-hmm. But what I saw from him is this industriousness that everybody could be a part of. And I think that was the scene that, again, I go back to that emotion that I think Valerian is working with, that there is something that the father is trying to do to live this American dream, no matter what. I mean, he's supposed to be a mechanical engineer, but he can't. So he becomes the ice cream man, which in some ways erases his identity because it becomes that American thing. It becomes a symbol of Americanness that you can serve ice cream out of a truck, which, you know, I guess I guess at that time they were still in Utah, that was a big deal. And so that's the closest to Americanness he's gotten. But when he goes to Nigeria, I don't think we get a clearer sense of that in the same way as there's attempts at understanding the Americanness. I think when he's in Nigeria, it's actually a passage I was looking for, so I don't want to waste too much time to try to find it. But I think he wants to take parts of Africa back to him, or parts of Nigeria back with him, but only thing he can take is the memory of it. Mm-hmm. Because what's physical and about giving out ice cream and tasting ice cream isn't the same as meeting your relatives. There's something real there. There's something emotional there, but it's not as tangible, I would say. And I think in America, it's almost always about tangibility. And your Americanness is something that's tangible, that it's not just something you can see, you can touch it. And I think that those of us who are not commonly seen as American usually struggle with trying to figure out what makes that American in us. Mm-hmm.
So I am loving this, because that was the ice cream truck was one of my favorite, and to me, probably the best written part of the whole book. It just read so true. It rang so true. I used to have these conversations with my other friends who were children of immigrants. They used to always start one time my parents, right? And we would talk about, it was always about these zany, harebrained small business schemes that they would come up with. And the ice cream truck wasn't even a permanent thing. It was a seasonal thing, a way to make a lot of money in a short amount of time. You know, and I remember, my parents coming home one day, we're going to sell this now. And I'm like, okay. And I knew the we meant all of us, I was now signing up for this thing too. And so that part, and what you're saying, Kofi, I think is so true. It is such an American thing, the idea of I can just start this thing and make money. I can make money. And it's the idea of possibility, anything is possible. And that's sort of the soft power that Fuller talks about, that America has this image that you can come here and you can make something out of nothing, right? And it's the hustle, right? You buy the ice cream truck, you buy the old post office truck, you convert it into an ice cream truck, you buy an old freezer, just buy a bulk ice cream. And it just seems so possible. And that's the American part of it that really struck me. And then in Nigeria, you're so right. It's not as tangible, what makes you Nigerian. And for all intents and purposes, Tunde is American. He was born here. That's what his national, his citizenship lies, but his cultural identity, his, ethnicity, it has to be informed by something else too, because you're right. There are these tangible things that make you American, but there are these intangible things that make you something else. And you're so right. In the part of the novel that takes place in Nigeria, it's nothing like the sort of episodes or the vignettes that take place in Texas or Utah or wherever he's at. It's almost spiritual connection more so in Nigeria, just the emotional and spiritual connection that he comes to. I wonder if he had chosen to live there for, a decade, if it would be a little bit different. Mm-hmm. But even I'm not going to give the ending away totally, but even the ways in which the resolution isn't a full resolution, it's more of an internal understanding of things rather than okay, now I'm going to get married, have kids, and, have this and become a writer. you don't get that. But in America, I feel like you would get that. But in this part of the ending, seems to me almost mystical in a sense.
I think that sort of too also points to the gap that we see in the novel between the first generation of the immigrant, the parents, and then the second generation. And I experienced it as somebody who came as a child to America. And I think that belief in the first generation immigrant that you can do anything, right? You would just buy the truck, put some ice in it, and you can sell ice cream. And, that's the kind of attitude or belief that's in contrast to something else that he or they knew before coming to America, right? Which is what brought them to America. But then as people who are born here and are, as you're saying, American, right? We don't experience America that same way, right? We don't have that same attitude or hopes and dreams. We're not coming here with all of those prior sort of beliefs. And I think we see that gap in Tunde and his father too, right? And what struck me was that, you know, the couple of times he talks about that phrase, a particular kind of Black man. And one of the things that I would say he's also exploring is maybe some kind of difference between the identity of the African American and the Black American. And he, this is page 134, where he says, and maybe this kind of sums up the main issue for him. This was my main problem, he says. I had no idea how to be Black. I mean, I was Black, I am Black, I can't change that, but I had no idea how to be a Black American. And he, the text italicizes that word American. And then he says, an African American. Even though I'd spent my entire life in America, I had no idea how to be Black, like Will Smith, like Michael Jordan, and so on and so forth. And so there's something there too, like throughout the novel, where there is the African heritage-ness versus the Black people living in America. And like the terms that we use too, right? Like, when do we say Black American and when do we say African American, and who gets to say that and who gets to be called one or the other, which we didn't really, you know, don't have time to get into now, but I think that's another big theme here that is really important in the novel.
Absolutely. I would say it's running through and through and through. But I guess it's time for us to wrap things up. Going on and on and on.
We're just getting started, I feel.
Time flew by, man.
I feel like we were just scratching the surface.
We were.
I think Topi Falerian has another novel forthcoming, perhaps. And I will continue to check for that. He is by far one of my best reads this year for 2021.
Yeah.
That is high praise. Everyone, we highly encourage you to check out A Particular Kind of Black Man by Topi Falerian, and check us out on YouTube, dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under Bookish for the podcast version. And if you're awake at random hours of the morning, you'll probably find us on TV. I just feel like I have to insert that every time because it's so random. Yep. Thanks everyone for joining us, and tune in next time
Holidays and Happy New Year.
Happy holidays and Happy New Year.
Yes. By the time you all hear this, it'll be 2022. Happy New Year, everyone.
Thank you. Bye.
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 Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.